Hi, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. Today, my guest is Rob Virchow, author of the award-winning new book, The Octopus in the Parking Garage, A Call for Climate Resilience. Professor Virchow, I'll just call him Rob, is a leading climate law scholar who designed and implemented climate resilience policies in the Obama administration. Before graduating from Harvard Law School, Rob majored in English at Stanford, where his senior thesis topic was Mark Twain and comic theory. I have got to ask him about that. It's not something you'll see in his official buttoned-up bio. Rob holds the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. And he's also a senior fellow in disaster resilience at Tulane University. Plus, Rob serves as president of the Center for Progressive Reform. He has written four other books in addition to The Octopus in the Parking Garage. And he hosts the podcast Connect the Dots. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, Rob, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I mean, the semester is over and my students are, what time is it? Oh, my students are at this moment, like on about to begin, I think hour three of my final exam. So I'm good because I'm in that sort of liminal space where I'm done with classes, but I have no exams to grade. So
isn't
that
right? That's good.
How about you? How are you?
Very good. I'm up here actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts right now.
Why? You should be in Louisiana.
I should be. I was recently in Louisiana, but this year I am a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Studies at Harvard University.
Wow. So, that's a great space. Good for you.
It's wonderful. It's a little cold, but I'm not going to complain about that. It's actually wonderful. And I'm using the time this year to work on a second book, which is kind of a companion to Octopus in the Parking Garage. So
you say second book, but you've written several other books. You mean you just sort of made a second one on this topic?
That's right. Yeah. This one is going to be about ocean resilience. I wrote that chapter in Octopus about coral reefs, and I got so involved in it that I said, I have to write a whole book about oceans and reefs and kelp and coasts and all those things. So.
Well, I'm sure you probably know this, but if you're interested in coral reefs, a really nice place to visit is Cayman.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Have you been there before?
I have not been there before. I have been, I have dived a lot in the Caribbean, mm-hmm. And there's some beautiful reefs out there.
I love the Caribbean. I'm writing a book on tax policy, which gave me every good reason to go to places like Cayman and actually Jersey, which is a colder island in the English Channel. But I have to tell you, I have never been in a nicer body of water than right there. So I said to myself, I remember getting there. Maybe it was because it was like, you know, I hadn't traveled in 2 years after COVID, but I remember getting there. And before I even dropped my bag off in my hotel room and I just sort of sat in a lounge chair on the beach. And then when I got in the water to swim, I said to myself, why is it that tax evasion is, something I discovered so late in my career? I really missed a bet here. I could have had a different path. Cause it's always very nice places. It turns out, and they're very committed. I mentioned this cause they're very, very committed to saving the natural beauty there. I don't know if you know that, but it's
yeah, I do know. Yeah. They're very famous for that. So, yep.
Okay. So that's enough good about vacation, maybe because it's so cold, I'm thinking about that.
Yes.
So if you're not in New Orleans, nearby your Mojo Coffee, where in Cambridge, what's your favorite coffee spot there?
Oh, well, it's a really good question because there are a number of great ones. But right by I'm on the what's called the Radcliffe campus, which is Radcliffe Yard. And I would say within 5 minutes, there's this wonderful chocolatier that also has coffee. And I'm actually going there tomorrow morning to write. and to buy some chocolate.
Is it Burdix or what is the?
Yes, it is.
What a guess. And
you
so,
got it.
I know my chocolate and my coffee and those little mice are so cute.
Yes, exactly. And I love it because when I'm home in New Orleans, I'm a 5-minute walk to, as you say, Mojo Coffee, where I wrote most of that book. And there's something about, I don't know where you like to write, but I like to be in with some ambient noise around, but in a social situation in which nobody requires me to interact with them.
And that I think used a coffee to be, house. That's perfect. That used to be, you know, right. It feels like there's a boundary, but you are not alone. And the buzz, that sort of sound, you know, makes you not like listen to the little, you know, the arms of the clock tick. I've gotten, you know, it's funny. I used to always do that. And maybe it's because now I have kids and I actually have an office at home. I'm able to write at home, but for a long time, I would always be, lose myself in a space like that. So what I want to say is, obviously I read a lot of books, especially nonfiction. And, you know, so I think for nonfiction readers, I think normally, although I appreciate good writing, I'll tolerate acceptable writing if I'm going to learn something that I didn't know, even though I often want to edit. And it's such a pleasure to read a book written by someone who loves words and loves to work really hard to make our lives easier when we're reading it. I mean, you know, not just the stories that you tell, but the metaphors that you use just work so well. And so as I was reading, I thought, wait a second, he doesn't write like your typical law professor. So that's why I dug around and found your CV and was not at all surprised that you earned a BA in English with distinction from Stanford. So how did you decide to go from that into law? Do you miss fiction reading? Because I'm sure you spent a lot of time reading poorly written judicial decisions and painful statutes, et cetera.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. Because you work, as you know, because you're a wonderful writer, it takes a lot of work and a lot of time to make something sing when you're able to do that. And so, yes, I love reading and I still love fiction. And I'm happy to say that I'm in a situation in my law classes where I still assign fiction. I teach a course, for instance, in disaster law and policy. And every time we do that, we either read Oryx and Crake, which is a Margaret Atwood speculative fiction story, or we read Their Eyes Are Watching God, a very different kind
Zora
of book.
Zora Neale Hurston, I love
sure.
that book. Yeah.
Yeah, so I try to move that in. I've been really inspired by Martha Nussbaum, who does that, as you may know, teaches.
I didn't know she did that.
She teaches at the law school at Chicago. Right. She's a philosopher, and and she taught literature and fiction courses. I don't know if she does it still, but I always thought. Particularly, you know, because I'm so interested in all the bad things that can happen, and particularly the catastrophic things that could happen that haven't happened before, that it's a hard time to imagine something happening. I think that fiction is an exceptional way of imagining things that other people aren't thinking about, and also understanding the needs of human beings in extreme circumstances. That's what novelists do. They put their characters in extreme circumstances. Often, if they're writing something speculative, like Margaret Atwood tends to do, she's imagining things that you thought, oh, that could never happen. And then you think about it again, you're like, oh, well, maybe
Uh-oh.
It could.
Thanks,
right?
Margaret. Yeah. Kind of like, yes. So it's interesting because that you're drawn to sort of the world of physical disaster. I'm drawn to financial catastrophes.
Yes, exactly.
I didn't think of it that way. Oh, man. I really hate floods too, which is obviously a part of Their Eyes Were Watching God and sort of just, you know, all the biblical and stories of floods. And I think I think with climate change, it brings a lot of, we've just had several floods in where I live in my home. And, you know, you just think about climate change, which I say now as opposed to global warming, which I think we all do. But there's just so much extreme weather. And I know that you have, you know, in New Orleans, obviously, that has occurred. And I think for me, it's the unpredictability of the fires, of the floods, of, you know, that is really unbearable. Okay. But on a happier note, so I just want to just touch on one other thing. So I thought it was really cool on your CV that you put what you wrote your senior thesis on, and it was Mark Twain and comic theory. I myself dodged a senior thesis by instead doing a directed reading where we read all of George Eliot's novels.
Oh, sweet.
although I have to say, sad enough, I didn't finish Middlemarch, which is really, like, really bad. My favorite of hers is Daniel Deronda for a number of reasons. But Mark Twain and comic theory. I did not invite you on the program to talk about that, but could you just, if you can think back, can you tell me, because I love Samuel Clemens. I think he's, you know, possibly, you know, he's in top, one of my favorite, one of the best American writers. And I was just telling these guys I had on the show how similar their humor was to his. But tell me, can you remember what you wrote about?
Yeah, you know, I haven't thought about this in years and years and years. But I too love Mark Twain, and what I was writing about, as you were saying, it was comic theory. I went through this stage where I was very interested in understanding why comedy works and how timing works and what the state of mind is behind a situation in which even something really uncomfortable can make somebody laugh. And so the idea that I was working with was really ideas about play, people playing. And what I, you know, asserted, I don't know if it, you know, makes sense or not, but what I asserted was is that I thought the characters, and I thought Mark Twain as a writer was most successful when they were lost in themselves.
The reader thinks they're smarter. The reader has more awareness and they have no self-awareness, the characters?
Well, in some way, you know, it's even when Huck Finn and Jim are on a raft and they pass the last area on the Mississippi where they would be able to get Jim to freedom. And part of it is because they're sort of involved in this sort of fantasy of theirs. And there's a lot of real emotion and real connection. And I think that, you know, if I could just sort of pinpoint it, something that I think is really neat about that is when you're lost in play, when you're not corrupted by the other influences, either, you know, too sarcastic or too supportive of whatever the hierarchies are, when you're kind of lost and you can imagine your own kind of world and way of being, that's when you can start imagining what a better world and what better relationships look like. And I think that the relationship between Huck and Jim is sort of formed at that time when they are not thinking about sort of the rest of the world. And then the key is once you kind of understand that that's possible, is so how do I make a society where that is possible, right? Mm-hmm. Where we can imagine a new way of being, a new kind of hierarchy, not influenced by these other sort of power dynamics.
Do you think the fact that you appreciate comedy and you seem to be, you have sort of, you present yourself, you seem happy, that disposition makes it easier for you to deal with what is one of the, you know, this major existential crisis of our lifetime without either burying your head under a rock and forgetting about it or jumping off a building?
Yeah. Although I have to say,
no, I'm sorry. I shouldn't even joke. I'm not trying to joke about this at all.
No, I know. And a theme of the book and a theme of when I teach is that you have to be, in order to face things, you have to be able to engage with them and you have to understand a problem. And if something is too scary, and you're not prepared for that, you're likely to avoid it. You know, I don't want to see that. It's or read that. I'm often asked, and we'll get to, I'm sure, the title of the book, which is Octopus in the Parking Garage. But, yes. But the whole idea is that it conjures a kind of fantasy, and the book cover itself, you know, is sort of engaging in almost a comic book way. And the idea there is not to make light of anything, but to say, look, let's start talking about a kind of a whimsical real world example. And once we get okay with that, then we can start going further. I've talked about this book to middle school students at middle schools, and mm-hmm. where the teachers are like, oh, are they going to get scared by climate change? And they actually don't. They actually get they get fascinated by how an octopus got into a parking garage. That's what they're fascinated about.
No, it's, I mean, and we will get to that, I promise. I just have a couple more things that I'm just thinking about, which is one question about your background. But before that, you mentioned teaching. And, you know, I just want to say that, you know, both of us obviously not only teach at law schools, but went to law schools. Mm-hmm. And I can assure you that paddling a kayak in a bayou or wherever it was not part of my law school experience. And I just want to read this piece of the book that you wrote about that, and then ask you how the students respond to actually getting out and, you know, touching grass. Okay, so here's what you wrote. A 40-odd minute drive from New Orleans. How do you pronounce this word? Maurepas?
Maurepas.
Okay. A 40-odd minute drive from New Orleans, Maurepas Swamp consists of about 96 square miles of flooded forest consisting mainly of water tupelo and bald cypress trees, and the root-like knees of the latter poking out of the water like dragon's teeth. Dripping with Spanish moss, their branches shade an understory of wax myrtle, pumpkin ash, and an abundance of things that slide and crawl. Very nice. So do you go on field trips often for this class?
Once a semester, we go on field trips, either paddling in bayous, or we're very close to a place called Cancer Alley, obviously, a corridor of petrochemical plants where there are a lot of environmental justice communities living within that. And we have community members lead us in a bicycle ride through Cancer Alley, and then stop occasionally and learn from the community members about how their lives are, how the petrochemical industry is, how those petrochemical plants are on plantations or what used to be plantations, and how the largest slave revolt in the history of the United States took place right exactly in that area.
So I think there's something about it's much more powerful to experience than just to read about things. And I think it's great that you're giving the students that. So how did you, before we jump into the book, you worked in the Obama administration at the EPA, and your job was to help design climate resilience programs. How did you, was that one of these Senate confirmed positions, or did you get to dodge the confirmation hearings?
I dodged the confirmation. I was in the Office of Policy at EPA, which is technically within the administrator's office of the EPA. I worked with Lisa Heinzerling, who was my boss.
Oh, right. That makes a lot of sense because you're both at CPA.
Yeah. Yeah,
Center
for Progressive Reform, and she had the position of the associate administrator, the leader of that office, and then I was her second in command, and the job of that office primarily is to monitor all of the regulation that goes through the Office of EPA under all of the statutes that EPA has authority under. It is also an office that has special projects. And at the time, President Obama had created an interagency task force on adapting to climate change. And so different members, every agency within that task force had a representative. And so I was representing EPA. And as in that task force, the work that I was involved in took a little over 2 years or whatever. And we were developing programs for the agencies themselves, the federal agencies, to become more resilient to climate change.
So, okay, let's talk about this octopus in the parking garage. First the reality, then the metaphor, and then your book.
Well, there really was an octopus in the parking garage. Back in 2016, in Miami, right on Biscayne Bay, there is a beautiful apartment complex, condominium complex, which I last visited just last spring, actually, when I gave a book talk in Miami.
Oh, wow.
And anyway, so you've got this really beautiful condominium complex. There was a guy who lived in that complex. His name was Richard Conlon. He's a real estate agent. And he was going to work one day, walking into the multi-stage parking garage of this big development. And there was water everywhere, just covering the tires of all of the cars. And then he looked really carefully and he saw this rubbery thing flip-flopping in the water. And it was a real octopus. It was about like twice the size of a large pizza. And he did, you know, what you would have done, what I would have done. He took out his phone and he started taking pictures and he put them on Facebook. And it became a thing. And it made the newspapers. And of course, I shouldn't say of course, but we're lucky that they got that octopus out of there and back in the water. And it turns out it's a story about climate change.
Because let me just stop you here, because the first thing I want to know is how the heck did an octopus, right, get in the parking garage? Your book explains it, but can
yes.
you explain it?
Well, yeah, so it's a climate change issue. So
yeah.
So this garage had a pipe, right, a drainage pipe that went all the way down to Biscayne Bay. And the idea is that the water goes, if it collects in the garage, it goes down through the pipe and into the bay. But because of some squirreliness with the tides at the time, and also because of sea level rise, many of those storm pipes on Biscayne Bay are now underwater permanently because the Biscayne Bay is higher. And so there was a poor octopus down there feeding at the end of a drain pipe, and the tides shift very quickly. And the pressure reverses, and so it gets sucked up.
Oh,
and then
my God!
Out.
And they're very. I think you know this about them, but they're very shapeshifters. These octopi.
Oh yeah,
the octopi, whatever the plural. I mean, they can just kind of get under a door. I mean, we know that they don't have bones or anything, and so they can kind of escape from many places anyhow. So somehow it was very easy for it to get sucked up through this drain pipe and
yeah.
then pushed up into the garage. It's unbelievable.
And so anyway, this happened, it got on the newspapers, and a friend of mine, a law professor his name is Dan Farber, he's at Berkeley, he emailed me this, and I said, no, it's Photoshopped. He's like, no,
right.
It's a real picture.
No, it had to be Photoshopped, right? Because it's always like, they always have the shark, right? Photoshopped
exactly.
somewhere.
That's what I said. and so we got to talking, and we said, well, we need to write an op-ed about this. So we did. We wrote an op-ed for the Miami Herald called The Octopus in the Parking Garage. And basically said it was an eight-armed alarm bell to get ready for climate. Because if we can't keep cephalopods out of parking lots, what else can't we do?
That's such a good word, cephalopod. I just love it. Anyhow, go ahead.
That's it.
That's it. So, but here's the thing. So then you see this as a metaphor. But so the piece of this, just to go back to the climate change piece, was it the erratic tides, or can you speak more to, or was it more just that the sea level had risen so much that these pipes were previously not underwater were? Like, what is the shift that made this happen?
Yeah. Well, like many impacts that we worry about because of climate change, it's a situation in which there are many causes all braided together. All mm-hmm. right. And so obviously there is some sea level rise going on in Biscayne Bay. And it is true that many of those pipes now are permanently underwater on account of that. What what caused the real shift in pressure in this particular situation was that there was what's called a king tide, which is a particularly strong and exaggerated tide. It's part of a natural system, a king tide. And there was a super moon, which happens to be a situation in which the moon is very close to Earth, causing a greater gravitational pull. So you'd have all of these things basically stacked up on top of each other, and then boom, a particular thing happens. And, you know, that's not unlike many of the heat waves that we saw this summer, because, you know, climate change is part of that story, but El Nino, which is a natural cyclical weather event, was also part of that. And then there was, you know, these atmospheric inversions, which happened because of geography. And in some cases, those are pretty natural too. But if you put all of those things together, you end up getting these sometimes very catastrophic events. And this was catastrophic for the octopus, I think we'd agree. So, you know, these things, we're going to see more of this kind of thing. And as I learned, and as I say in the book, there actually is a group of people trying to figure out, how do you screen out stuff from going up the drains, either with one-way valves or, you know, some kind of screen mechanism or whatever. It's a problem.
And you mentioned people, these buildings are so old. I think this one is like from 1968, maybe, that they don't even know where all these pipes are, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So one last octopus-specific question. Have you seen the film My Octopus Teacher?
Yes, I did. I loved it.
I need to watch it. I heard it's really gorgeous, but I'm sad. I mean, spoiler alert, they only live for a year, right?
That's right. And this guy... It's a wonderful story, but he is a little crazy. I mean, he's free diving in water that's really, really cold off the coast of South Africa. And, I mean, he couldn't have been in that water more than 20 minutes each time. I mean, it's cold.
Do you dive or do you just snorkel?
I dive, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to learn to do that?
It doesn't take so long to be able to do it. It takes a longer time to get kind of good at it. Mm-hmm. I had a sabbatical a couple of years back that I spent in French Polynesia, actually, on mm-hmm. an island called Mo'orea, where there are two marine stations that I was interested in working with. And I got to the point where I was diving maybe every other day. And that's finally when you get to the point where you learn how to control your breath and you're not just relearning the things you learned the last time you did it. You know, you're actually moving forward. So it was really helpful.
I admire people who can do that, because I remember when I was a kid, I'd be, you know, on a vacation, and there'd be these people practicing in the pool, just like even falling upside down into the pool, you know? Mm-hmm, and I'm right, like, no, I can't even do that without having a panic attack. Okay, let's switch to the book. And I'm going to ask you some big sort of broad questions that will then get us to dive more into it. But, you know, a lot has been written about climate change. And I'm curious how you see your focus here on what the subtitle is, A Call for Climate Resilience. How is that focus, do you think, different from what people have been talking about before? And how is that sort of more hopeful, do you think, or make us feel like we have a little more control over our future?
Well, there are at least two things that I think make this book different from a lot of other very wonderful climate books. One thing is that this book is specifically about resilience. Job one, as we all know, is reducing carbon pollution. And the other job one is preparing ourselves for the impacts that we're not going to be able to avoid, which I call resilience. And so to have a book directly confronting that, I think, is a really important thing. The other thing that I really wanted to do was make this a book that was engaging in a way that it wasn't frightening. It is, mm-hmm. it is sober, it is real, it is factual, for sure. We are in dire straits, but we do have control over this. If we want to take control, we have all the technology we need. And the reason that I think it is sometimes easier to talk about resilience is that it's a value that I think people on different sides of the political spectrum share. Everybody knows what it's like to want to protect your family, to want to protect your house, to want to protect your job, and the place that you have grown to love, wherever that is. And when you see impacts hurting the things that you love, then you can start saying, okay, how do I adjust to that? Because I know I need to. We don't have to talk about in the very beginning, we don't have to talk about why it's happening or what share of climate change is doing what, or do you need to buy a Tesla? We don't have to talk about those things. We can just talk about very, very sort of basic concrete things that you can see. And then once we get involved in that, it's easier, I think, to continue to move on and learn about the more abstract issues that we face.
I think that's so smart, because impact right in front of people is I think, the most important thing in their lives. Yes, connecting yourself up to larger systems, of course, you know, that's important, but most people on a day-to-day level need to, in order to engage in the questions of why is this happening? And what can we do? They need to know what the it is, and the it has to be concrete. I want to ask you about some of the language that I used to use, and maybe the language has shifted. Years ago, when I first started teaching at a business school, I used to assign the book John Hansen and I think someone Dessler wrote called The Science and Politics of Global Climate Change. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was really transformative, because I thought it was really interesting, because it talked about why it was that you would have people in the sort of political sphere having wildly different rhetoric around what was really happening, were humans causing global warming and climate change more generally, and what can be done about it, and just explaining how those discourses work, introducing me to concepts that I hadn't been thinking about, like making the difference between, you know, a positive claim describing what is happening and a normative claim describing what your values are, all of that, and breaking it down, and also sort of what the norms are, what you're allowed to do inside of science, scientific discourse versus political discourse, all of it. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic book. But what I drew from that, and I read it so many years ago that I think it's maybe some of it is outdated, but the way they looked at the problem of climate change is that, or responses to it, one thing to do would be to mitigation. So mitigation being, how do we reduce CO2, you know, carbon emissions, for example, and then we also had to do adaptation, which I think is what you mean by resilience. But I like the word resilience better than adaptation. Things like building, you know, walls or moving. And the last thing they talked about, which totally scared the bejesus out of me, was geoengineering, involving things like, you know, giant mirrors redirecting the sun, which only sounded like some scary weapon. At any rate, has that vocabulary, that framing changed? Is resilience exactly mapped right onto adaptation, or is it a different concept?
They're similar. And I'm the first to tell you that people use these words, experts use these words, and sometimes mean different, sometimes don't understand one another. Resilience is a word that I like, but that, you know, has a different word in biology. It's a different meaning in biology, a different meaning in psychology, and so on. To me, adaptation is preparing for the impacts of climate change. Resilience certainly includes that. For me, what resilience brings into the picture is beginning to talk about not just adapting your system so that it can absorb a blow and then return to its former state. That's what a biologist might say resilience is, for instance. But to me, resilience has a social piece, which is about improving the society that you're actually in. We have a society, that has lots of wealth inequality and discrimination, for instance. And that actually turns out to be a real barrier to actually becoming more resilient to climate change, actually. And so what we want is not a society that, you know, responds to a hurricane by coming back to the way it was with the same old income inequality and racism. What we want is a society that doesn't have those things, and that because it doesn't have those things is actually better able to thrive in more erratic conditions.
Can you unspool that a little bit?
Yeah.
And describe for me the correlation between income inequality and not just the effects of climate change, but our slow responses to it.
Oh, sure. So it's pretty much everybody understands. I say people who study this, pretty much everybody agrees that disadvantaged people in society or communities in a society are going to be harder hit. That's true globally, and it's also true within the United States, because people have less money to build back. They have jobs that maybe require them to work outside that are more dependent on the weather. All kinds of things, like, you know, their public health issues are going to be created, and the people who have good health care are going to do better than people that don't. It leads though to a problem of action, because a lot of these sort of problems that we see first when climate hits are problems that don't necessarily affect wealthy, insulated people as much. So I talk about heat waves, and I think heat waves is a great example. So if we think of a heat wave as a natural disaster, although it has human causes too, but heat waves kill more people in the United States easily than any other kind of natural or weather-related disaster, 7 times more than floods do, right? Mm. And heat waves are one of the, what I would call a disaster, that's not even mentioned in something called the Stafford Act, which is the act that gives the president authority to declare
emergency, right,
a major disaster. And so it's not even listed. Well, it's because that the damage from heat waves, it does not show up as property loss primarily, the way it would in a flood or an earthquake or something like that. And the people who are most affected by heat waves are people of lower income, and as we know in the United States, disproportionately people of color. Many of them who are living without air conditioning or who are working outside.
Or in kitchens or wherever it's hot.
Right. Absolutely, or working in garages, you know, auto shops, garbage collection, construction sites, agriculture, right, all of that. Yeah.
And then they have less political voice. And so,
yeah. And, you know, a lot of the infrastructure that helps in these situations, whether it's leafy trees that keep places maybe 5 degrees, 10 degrees cooler, or fountains or swimming pools or parks, right, which more green space, all of those things we see, you know, in more advantaged areas. In fact, a study that came out just a couple of years ago found that heat islands, as they call them, urban heat islands, can be linked in 100 different American cities to redlining, basically to discriminatory loan practices in real estate.
And, you know, and of course, you know about the story pre-civil rights era during the civil rights era of communities, white communities or white people in communities shutting down public pools.
Sure.
Because they didn't want to integrate them and literally cementing them over. I had Heather McGee on the show in her fantastic book, Some of Us, talks about, what she talks about is drained pool politics as a metaphor and a reality. But I hadn't really thought until speaking with you the way that also creates real risk in these areas, in urban areas where there aren't always leafy trees and where there might be, you know, people outside and not able to cool off in the summertime.
Well, I'll tell you something else. In New Orleans, a lot of people don't know how to swim. And that is a disproportionately African-American phenomenon in the South, but certainly in New Orleans. And a lot of people during Hurricane Katrina drowned. And it was because they didn't know how to swim.
That's terrible. Okay. So I just to sort of recap to this, we're talking really now about climate resilience. Not that you're giving up on this idea of mitigation, but figuring out what resilience means. I think it's really interesting when you talk about biology and how we have evolved, not possibly a different theory instead of survival of the fittest, which we think associate with Darwin, but with Rick Pott's variability selection hypothesis, where actually more of a generalist in terms of genetically and how you have been socialized or raised makes you more capable of surviving volatile times. And I like what you write here. You say that here are the tools we have for resilience: long range mobility, mastery of tools, a bouquet of social skills. This is what our ancestors needed, you said, to survive on an erratic planet, plus our apparently supersized brains, although it doesn't always seem like we're using all of them. I get the sense that, you know how the internet is this incredible place where you can research anything, but a lot of people are watching cat videos. I think it's the same is true exactly with their brains. Right. It's like, really? I mean, nothing. I know, look, a good cat video, I'm sure, will cheer you up.
I watch cat videos.
That's not the point. It's about the variety.
People send me octopus videos. I'll tell you, another one. There are lots of octopus videos.
So, If we are built, you do a really interesting job of describing what you mean by resilience in the first part of the book. But and we've talked a little bit about what you mean, sort of resilience here. What does doing resilience entail? This is the whole second part of your book. Mm-hmm. How do we do resilience? And then I'm going to ask you why it matters and why we shouldn't just give up on everything.
Yeah, sure.
Why we shouldn't give up first, because I just want to get this off my chest. This is not actually how I feel, but there are some nihilistic skeptics out there who are going to shrug all this off, saying, listen, everyone told us we're past the tipping point anyway. Plus, we're all mortal. One day in the future, the sun is going to blow up and scatter the earth into like a cloud of astral dust. Why don't we just eat, drink, and be merry? And also, by the way, if you want to get mad at someone, don't give me a stupid paper straw that's going to limp in my Diet Coke. Why don't you just tell the billionaires to stop flying their private jets? Aren't they the problem? Okay, so talk me off the ledge on that one.
Well, that's good. Well, it's funny because I had an opportunity to do some talking people off the ledge recently. this book, I was grateful to learn, was a required read at Louisiana State University this fall. All the freshmen in their honors program, which was like 1,000 students, had to read this book.
So you noticed the Amazon sales in one day went up?
Oh, did I ever?
Like, what the heck is going on here, right?
So, and then they invited me to the campus to meet in small groups with the students and to give a talk and so on. And that's what was so wonderful about it. Because first of all, I want to say most of the students are on board. They want to help. They want to build a better world, right? They're not so many of the, I'm not going to get married. I'm not going to have kids, so on and so forth. But there is some of that, right? Mm-hmm. And, my father-in-law is 98 years old. He grew up in Denmark and he moved to the United States after World War II. He grew up as a teen, occupied by Nazis. And he and his wife, he was married in Denmark and they got married very soon after the war. But I remember, I talk to him a lot now. And I said, did you ever feel when you were 16 or 17 watching the Nazi soldiers, trample over all of your crops and things like this, did you ever think, geez, I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have kids. I'm just going to get drunk every night or whatever it is. I mean, did you think like that? And he's like, no, we didn't think like that. I mean, we knew it was awful, but we kept going. And I think that there's part of that's a generational thing that we could sort of get into and whatever. But I think that that when people are active and they're actually trying to solve even small problems, they need to get over themselves. I mean, I do too. I have to as well.
Right.
Because that's a human thing to sort of wallow. Right. And so people sometimes ask me, am I optimistic about all of this? And I don't think I'm optimistic in the sense that I think there's a 51% chance that it's all going to turn out right. I don't know whether it's going to turn out right, but I know that it could. And if I have some role to play in helping it turn out the right way, then I can't give up on that, even if the chances are small. And
you
that's sort
like
of how
that.
I get that. This is my idea. I get it from Desmond Tutu, who writes about it in a similar way, where he says that hope is, you know, is about being active and pushing for the future that you want to see. It doesn't have anything to do with whether you think it's going to happen or not. The point is that it could happen.
It's reminding me, it's very Talmudic what you're saying. There's something like, what is that, you know, you're not required to finish the work, but neither are you permitted to desist from it.
Oh, that's good. Exactly.
I don't know the exact phrase, but that, you know, that sort of, it makes you feel purposeful. Like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep pushing things forward because it doesn't feel good just to quit. Actually.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So let's dig into it then. Okay, so now you've talked me off the ledge, and now I'm really able. There's no obstacle to my ability to receive this information now about what it looks like. What this second section of your book, when you're talking about doing resilience, what does it entail? How do we start doing resilience?
Well, the first thing, and this can be at any scale, it could be your household or it could be the federal government, you have to think about what the vulnerabilities are. The first thing you think about is, what do you care about? Maybe you care about the value of your house. Maybe you care about your family. If you're in the federal government at the EPA, maybe you care about pollution prevention, pollution regulation. And so then you have to say, okay, whatever it is that I care about, how might climate change make that harder to achieve, right? And so maybe my house is in a floodplain, or maybe if I'm at the EPA and I'm trying to keep the air clean, I know that when it gets hotter, there's a longer ozone season. And that means that there are going to be more people who have aggravated asthma or whatever it is. And so then I can say, okay, so I got to identify sort of the things that are going to be harder. And now I have to start to think about what the ways of addressing that might be. If you're at the EPA, maybe you think about different standards for the things that for ozone or smog, right? Maybe you start saying, because we're going to have more smog, but just because of the weather or just because of the climate. So now we got to have better regulations for that. Or maybe you say, if it's your house, well, I need to get more insurance, or maybe I need to move, or maybe I need to not refinish my basement, or, you know, what?
No, we actually build out dig out this thing and change the grade and whatever. Yes,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Some people in my neighborhood in New Orleans raised their houses and put stilts underneath. And there's no right answer about what you should do. I mean, it has to do in part with what you can afford. It has to do in part with other sort of collective issues. But then you can go into a process of deciding, well, what do I choose? And one of the things that I explore in the book is that a lot of these solutions, or if you say ways of addressing it, are dependent on politics. They're dependent on collective action, what other people want to do. They're dependent on how much money you have, or how much money the level of government has. Rich folks are going to be able, if they're on the coast, they're going to protect that out here. And
they want,
you know,
they want the coastal.
They're going to build a big wall, maybe to protect Wall Street in New York City. Well, of course they are, right?
Right.
And maybe Houston, but they're not going to do that for the rural parishes in Louisiana where, you know, the indigenous populations and the Cajun fishers live.
And then for people who do care about others and care about social justice, there's a real space, as you know, for climate justice. And you can say, okay, this is how I could engage in a way where I can think about in my community, in my broader community of Americans here, or even across the globe, but even starting in your own community, like you were saying, if you live in Louisiana, thinking about how do you work with the government to either help other people move, right, from where they are or get the wall that they need to and so on, right?
Yeah, and the key really is, or one key, there are a few keys. So one key is, I always point out, is it has to be science-based, right? You can't just fool yourself and say, oh, it's going to be fine or whatever it is. It has to be science-based. And then it also has to be connected to the communities themselves. People have to have some kind of agency and say over what happens. That doesn't mean that you just pay for anything that people say they want, but it does mean that people have to be involved in making decisions like, is this community going to continue to be served by government services, you know, like electricity and plumbing? Are people gonna, you can't force a community to move, I don't think, not in a fair or efficient way. And
are there maps right now? I mean, you say in the book, you know, in prose, you know, that there are no safe spaces, yeah, not coastal Louisiana or Florida, Virginia, you say not Rapid City, South Dakota, and not coastal Alaska. So if there's no safe place, but there's some places where I'm sure there must be maps saying in 10 years, if we continue doing what we're doing or whatever the date is, this place is underwater. Like, are people being shown those maps?
Oh, yes. In Louisiana, we are actually ahead of the curve because we have so many problems related to our coast. We're the fastest sinking place on the planet. And I'm not kidding. So this is existential for us. And so in the book, I have a whole chapter, as you know, devoted to restoring the coast. But part of that plan is also to help communities that are interested in moving. And there are maps that you can find on the state government's website that basically names the communities and says in 20 years, these communities are going to have to move because they're essentially 14 feet below what's called the base flood elevation, which means during a flood, they're 14 feet under. And right now, you know, we're trying to raise money in the state of Louisiana to help move those communities.
Amazing. How do we, you know, you're engaged in this, your students are, there are a lot of people, but it's, you know, in the public, what do you think we should do? Or if you had your magic wand right now, or you were sitting, you know, at the White House and you had a seat at the table let's imagine the Supreme, you know, all three branches, you've got the Supreme Court justice, let's say you had the Congress and you had the president and they were all on your side. Mm. What would you do? Because you are at that intersection between law, policy, and climate. So is this a matter of law or is this a matter of human behavior or both? Like in the legal space, yeah, what would you do?
It's a matter of both because a lot of it is planning. You know, planning and okay, we plan for all kinds of stuff, right? We plan for financial meltdowns, not maybe as well as we should, right?
Please don't get me started on that.
Here's what
oh my God, no.
We're okay, both about ahead, the precautionary Bob. Principle, you and I, right? So
yeah.
But here's what I would say. I think the most effective thing, a single thing that we could do is have every state have a resilience czar. That is a state department, a state office with a person in charge. And the job in that office is to essentially ask the question that I asked before, which is what is it that we care about in all of the different agencies in the state? And how are we going to, what are our vulnerabilities? And how can we fix those?
Can that state office be funded by like the Department of Homeland Security? So, because the state budgets are pretty tight.
Yes. So that's where federal government. I mean, I have ideas about what we would do at the federal level.
Okay, but I love this idea of low. I shouldn't skip over the local and state.
But I think so. Right. Here's the thing. So some states have the equivalent of a resilience czar. Hawaii does, for instance. Uh-huh. And this is, it's not just my idea. There are many people who are thinking about this kind of thing. So here's what you might do. So for instance, in the United States, we think in the next 50 years, 12 million people will be moving from the coasts inland on account of sea level rise.
What was the time frame you just said?
40 to 50 years.
Okay.
All right. Now that sounds scary, but actually a lot of people move anyway. All right. I mean, there is a lot of, people move a lot. So 12 million, but that's still a lot. Now, if you look at the cities where those people that are going to be losing those people, I mean, we know what they are. They're Miami, they're New Orleans, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Norfolk, Virginia. There's been papers written about this, right? And then you could say, okay, where are these people going to go? And we know that too. And there are people who, geographers who've written about this, who've used data, historical data, to say, where do people move? And what we know is that Orlando is going to be a place that's going to be taking on a lot of people. Las Vegas is a place that's going to be taking on a lot of
people. So we need to be building roads and planning and all of the rest.
So if I ran Florida.
Well, not roads, I'm sorry. Maybe trains.
Yeah. So if you were in charge of Florida, right? God, you know, whatever. What you might do is you'd say, I want people in Miami talking to the people in Orlando now, right?
Oh my gosh, you make me so happy because I love to plan. If this is just like planning and not despairing, I feel better.
Well,
like
most people are going to move within their state. We also know that.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting.
And so there's a lot of, you know, and what I say, I grew up in Las Vegas. I grew up in Nevada. So I think a lot about deserts and heat waves. And I talked to you about heat waves. You might not know this, but there are only like 6 or 7 states in the whole country that guarantee to outdoor workers shade, water, and rest.
Name one state that does that.
I'm
surprised.
There are a few in the Northeast. Okay.
Oh, wow.
But I'll tell you, Nevada is not one of those states.
Oof.
Arizona is not one of those states.
The sand states don't even do it. Unbelievable.
In Texas, it is against the law for cities to guarantee those things to outdoor workers.
My gosh.
Right? So, but if you had a czar, you might say, you know, bring in the different agencies related to worker protection, right? And you might say, hey, you know, sometimes they're doing it on purpose. Texas, they're doing it on purpose. In Nevada and Arizona and other places, they're not, you know. So you could say, hey, so why don't you have coverage over your bus stops? Why during a heat wave do the buses take a half hour to show up while someone's waiting and passing out? And those aren't things people are necessarily thinking about on a day-to-day level in government. But if you had somebody whose job it was to think about that.
And if you think about it, if you plan ahead, businesses could spring up that could provide. It seems like there's a business opportunity to like do, you know, requests for RFQs, or quotes, or, you know, RFPs for businesses to be creating those bus shades.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I mean, there's like, you could be thinking ahead in this way. So it's interesting. I mean, you would think that would happen. Yeah. Okay. So we sadly have to wrap this up, but I'm feeling much better now than when we started about this topic. And I wonder, what didn't I ask you that you think is important to still talk about?
One of the things I'm very proud of in this book is that I met and talked with a lot of people who are doing, I'll say maybe what you might think of as ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And not just on their own, but in large collectives, you know. And so I talk about a woman that I've known for a long time, Sharon Levine, who's an environmental activist. She's in her 70s. She's a retired special ed teacher. But she's internationally known now as an environmental activist in Cancer Alley. One of the things that she taught me is that you go with what you care about. They cared about pollution in their neighborhoods, and she noticed that after storms, there's more pollution that comes out of these factories and plants because they lose their electricity and they don't have backup units. And she's organized within her church and so on large groups to inform the EPA and others about these issues. One of my favorite people that I talk about in the book is a young woman named Cara Norman. She was 15 when I first interviewed her. She learned to scuba dive in middle school outside of her school activities because she didn't like science in school. But once she learned about scuba diving, she and all the other middle school girls in her scuba diving group got really interested in science.
I love that.
They all want to be marine scientists, and now they're actively working to restore coral reefs along with many other citizen divers. And they replant 50,000 corals every year. In the Caribbean. And and so not only are they doing a good thing, but they're building their own lives. You know, Cara never would have wanted to be a scientist if she hadn't done this. And now that's all she wants to do. And so these young women, most of them that I write about in this particular program, they want to be they're scientists. That's what that's how they define themselves.
I love that. It's so true. It's, you know, and I think this relates to, I'm sure you hear people ask you this question, what class should I take or what should I study? And it's like, what do you love?
That's what I tell them.
You know, like, don't worry about what you think is going to look good on paper. You got to follow your bliss. You got to follow your passions, and you'll really learn a lot if you're doing that, for sure.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with me, but more importantly, for writing this book. I look forward to, I guess, not the sequel, but the companion book that you're working on right now. Really enjoy. Don't forget, when you go to Burdick's, they do have hot chocolate there.
Oh, I'm more of a coffee person,
but you know, and you can indulge, I think, this time of year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that conversation. I think it's the first time I've engaged with someone in the topic of climate change where I end up feeling more empowered instead of more depressed. And I think that can be attributed to the important work that Rob does in both explaining the problem and what we can do about it and remaining level-headed and enthusiastic about the steps that we can take to deal with the problem. There's something I meant to ask him about. He really is fond of Desmond Tutu, as he mentioned. And there's this lovely quote and the acknowledgement from that, and from him. And he wrote, "Desmond Tutu said that in life, the path of joy is connection with others. So it is with writing a book. In this endeavor, a lot of joy and labor were shared." That's how he began his acknowledgments. And he goes through it. And he's such a generous person. Not only does he think, you know, sometimes in people's acknowledgments, they're thanking their big, you know, people who influence their thinking or help them along. But he was really very kind and thanked the students who helped him and other folks who informed his work, which I truly, truly appreciated. So I want to thank you for spending this time with us every Sunday. And I will, of course, be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let us know what you think. I love getting mail at bookedup@politicon.com. And you can also write to me on paper at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help others find the show.